On today's episode, Miguel Montero kicks rocks as the Cubs move on from their embattled backstop. Was it the right move for the team's chemistry? Will Victor Caratini make the team forget about Montero? And is Anthony Rizzo probably calling David Ross about a comeback? Plus, RJ's ghost hunting buddy John Gray is back on the bump. Bartolo Colon perhaps makes his last ride. And key players for the Nats, Yanks, and Brewers all hit the DL. It's the DFA Podcast. And welcome to episode 15 of DFA, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus. I'm Brian Grosnick of BP, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, happy Friday. Excited for the weekend?
Absolutely. I'm excited for the show.
All right. We're off to a great start. So since we're in a good mood, since we're off to a good start, let's talk about somebody being DFA'd and losing their job. So the big move for this last couple of days is probably all the drama surrounding Miguel Montero and his DFA and what we assume is impending release from the Chicago Cubs. What do you think about this this move with Montero?
Sort of reminds me of the part in Moneyball where Billy Bean trades Jeremy Giambi and he's like, this is probably the worst move I've ever made as a executive or whatever, but the best move I've made as a general manager.
Yeah.
And you know, it has the human side of the equation weighed heavier than the baseball side because Montero had been playing well, albeit in a part-time, heavily platooned role. He had a 112 OPS plus. He's still a good framer. Obviously, he's not very good as a marksman anymore. But his points about Arrieta's slowness to the plate are valid, although they probably shouldn't be said publicly and certainly not delivered in the way that he delivered them. But yeah, this is a case where the Cubs actually are probably lowering their talent level, but potentially getting better as a clubhouse and as a baseball team, if that makes sense. Where, you know, they're getting better in one regard, but it's not the regard that we would expect them to get better in.
Yeah, I definitely kind of agree with you that this is definitely less of a baseball move than a hey, it's time to rally the troops. We've got to do something to shake things up because we are unexpectedly bad. What do you think about the whole drama surrounding Montero and his comments? Do you think they're overblown? Do you think that the reaction was relatively appropriate? Why don't you walk us through what happened there and what your kind of thoughts are on that?
So Montero and Jake Arrieta gave up 7 stolen bases against the Nationals, 4 of them to Trey Turner. And afterward, Montero essentially absolved himself of blame, saying that he had no chance because his pitcher was slow to the plate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's valid. But from there, it devolved quickly for Montero. You know, Anthony Rizzo came out and called him a selfish player, and then he was designated for assignment a couple hours later. You know, he tweeted some classy stuff afterwards, then went on the radio show and was like, I'm sure Anthony Rizzo misses David Ross. So, you know, things got a little spicy in that regard. But basically, you know, Montero has a reputation of being a little outspoken and at times a little cloying. And this just seems like a continuation of that. He's a solid backup catcher. You know, he's fine, but you have to deal with the personality quirks. And the Cubs said, we don't want to be snug at this point where, like you said, a disappointing season and they need to rally the troops. And, you know, frankly, if you're going to annoy someone in Chicago, it should probably not be Anthony Rizzo. You know, they're going to do whatever to keep Rizzo happy. And this is just an example of where, you know, Montero probably overestimated his sway or underestimated the impact his comments would have publicly.
Yeah, back when he was with the Diamondbacks, he also had a reputation as a bit of a I don't want to say like a loudmouth, but he was outspoken. And I think that probably had some play in his departure from that franchise as well. So, you know, it's not exactly the most surprising thing in the world to see Montero say something and have it put people off. But, you know, just like you said, you know, going up against Arrieta and Rizzo is probably not a great idea, especially considering the Cubs seem to value their club chemistry so much. So with him moving on, It looks like Victor Caratini is going to come up and be the new backup, because I assume David Ross is unavailable due to his many, many television commitments. Not that the team would even want Ross back, I assume, unless it was in a kind of a clubhouse grandfather role. But catcher has been kind of a strong point for the Cubs this year, I feel like, because Wilson Contreras has been hitting okay. Montero, like you said, has been playing pretty well. Contreras has improved as a defender. He's not on Montero's level, I don't think, yet, but he's improved as a defender. Do you want to talk a little bit about Caratini? I like Caratini as a prospect. I think it'll be interesting to see him come up and see what he can do, but he's more of an offensive guy than he is a defensive guy as a recent convert to behind the plate. Do you like Caratini as a backup, or do you think that the Cubs maybe need to do something else to shore up the position as they struggle to catch the Brewers?
I could definitely see them going out and getting someone else. I would note that Caratini, thus far at least, has appeared in two games. He's played the corner outfield positions. He hasn't caught at all yet. Mm-hmm. So there's some versatility there. The question with Caratini, at least the question used to be, is he going to be able to stick behind the plate defensively, as well as, you know, his offensive skill set is pretty hit tool heavy. He's going to have to hit for a good average in order to have a lot of value there. If he can stick behind the plate, though, that obviously, you know, lessens the need for him to hit a ton. And if he's just a backup, that lessens it even more. But, you know, he doesn't fit your typical backup pitcher mold. I suppose I wondered a little bit when this went down whether the Cubs would go out and sign Derek Norris to a minor league deal. And I know, you know, they supposedly value character highly, but they also, you know, went out and traded for Aroldis Chapman last July. So I don't know what to make of that. I don't know if they would bypass Norris, and, you know, frankly, they can bypass Norris for performance-related reasons and pass it off as character-related reasons. But I think they'll probably shop around for another backup. I can't imagine Caratini as the backup the rest of the way.
Yeah, I would be surprised if he's consistently on this team. There's always a backup catcher available. There's not always a good backup catcher available. I mean, there's the league is lousy with, you know, third catcher types, your Eric Kratz's, Michael McHenry's, guys who show up in transaction analysis four times a year. But for a guy that's really going to help out a Cubs team that's really looking for someone who needs to be a solid backup catcher, the one guy who jumps out at me as a trade target that might be really good for the Cubs is Rene Rivera of the Mets. He doesn't have the versatility that the Cubs usually look for, but he's a great framer, a good defensive player, and generally speaking, a good clubhouse hand. He's the type of guy I could see the Cubs going after, because it would probably be a very low barrier to acquisition. They probably wouldn't have to give up too much to get somebody like that. I don't know. I can't really think of too many other guys who are going to be available. You mentioned Norris, but I don't know beyond that if there's a lot of other freely available or low-cost talent the Cubs could go out and get.
Probably Nick Hundley, I would guess, would be available. Yeah. He's on a one-year deal. He hasn't played tremendously, but that's the type of dude who should shake available. Otherwise, yeah, you're right. It's not going to be – there doesn't seem to be a trade market that's going to be overflowing with these types. That doesn't mean that someone like maybe Avila doesn't shake loose, or, I mean, if the Braves were to fall out of it, maybe Tyler Flowers, but, you know, he's probably too good to accept a backup role at this point. So, yeah, it's going to be, I don't know, maybe they call up Milwaukee and try to get one of their dozen catchers who were caught up in between. I know that's not going to happen, but yeah, there's not a clear choice otherwise, and I guess I'm curious to see what they do, but frankly, this team, backup catcher, is not the most pressing need or, you know, the deciding factor on whether they make the postseason or not, so.
Nick Hundley is a great name, and I mean that literally, because, you know, the Cubs have this history of Randy Hundley and Todd Hundley playing for the team, who are, you know, obviously related, but Nick Hundley is not. But I think it would be great for them to acquire him and run him out there, because I think it would just add to the confusion where everybody seems to think that Nick Hundley is related to Todd and Randy. So that would help me out, I think, a lot.
Team Anarchy.
So Montero moves on. Do you think he finds a landing spot real quickly?
I'm torn on this one.
Yeah, because I would imagine that the DFA would mean that the Cubs will actually be able to trade him in this case. I don't know he'll just wind up being released, but I'm not really sure, and I don't know what team would kind of go after trying to pick him up.
Right. I mean, normally we would say the Rays, but they just got Wilson Ramos back, so that doesn't seem likely. I don't think they're going to be able to find a trade partner for him unless they just eat all the money, because I feel like every other team realizes they just want to get rid of the dude. This wasn't performance related. This was clearly, you know, character related. They don't have any other choice here. They're either going to eat the money and release him. I mean, they're not going to send him to the minors. You know, you're certainly not going to send him to the minors. So I don't know. I could see a team signing him and, you know, holding their nose for the next few months, holding their ears, hoping he doesn't say anything bad about them. But I don't know if there's a specific team that pops to mind. I mean, maybe the Nationals. Could they, you know, I could see them potentially signing him and replacing Lobatone with him, but I don't know that there's a guarantee of that either. So I think he'll get another job because, you know, he's too talented. He's performing too well not to. I just don't know that it's going to come quickly, and I don't know that it's going to necessarily be on a good team either, but we'll see.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking staying in Chicago and going to the White Sox might be a good fit, although I'm sure he doesn't want to have to deal with the Chicago media any longer after this, so it might not be the best fit for him personally, but, you know, the White Sox have been rolling with Omar Narvaez, and, you know, that would be a good place for him to try to rehabilitate some value. I kind of agree with you that it's going to be a team that's probably out of contention where he'll look to just keep his head down, deliver, do some good things at the plate and behind the dish, and see if he can get a better contract for 2018 out of it.
And one last note on Montero. Supposedly he wants to start an agency after his playing days are over, so maybe he's just looking to streamline that process and you know, get used to making bombastic statements for his next job after playing days are over. So
there are worse ways to go about it. There's plenty of better ways to go about it, but there, I suppose there are also worse ways to go about it. So happy trails, Miguel. I do hope he finds a spot and plays well, because, you know, I just like to watch him play. I think he's a pretty fun guy to watch, and he's got a lot of talent, but not the way his tenure in Chicago was expected to end, or I think anybody wanted it to end. So we'll move on to our rapid fire segment. We're keeping it relatively short today, and there's been a few moves in the league, but not a ton. So we'll bring Sean on, and Sean can start throwing us our batting practice topics.
Hi guys, not a few, but there are some big ones, and the biggest being that Trey Turner broke his wrist after being hit by a pitch in last night's game. He's going to be out for quite a while. So does this put the Nationals on the trade market for a shortstop?
Yeah, that's I mean, probably, right?
Like, this is the season for the Nationals, right? We all assume that they're 100% all in on trying to get to the World Series this year. What with the question marks about their pitching health, which has remained healthy for the most part this season. They went out and got Adam Eaton. I mean, it seems like they're 100% all in on trying to win it all this year. So how do they not call the Cincinnati Reds about Zach Cozart now? I don't see much of a situation. I don't know how many other really good shortstop options there are out there to kind of replace Turner, but they've probably got to add somebody, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, you can't continue to roll with Wilmer Defoe and Steven Drew if you're trying to not only make the postseason, but, you know, make the most of this year and win the pennant. So I would expect them to call about Cozart. I'm trying to think of another option out there, and I mean, he's really the top dog, and beyond that, you're getting into the murky waters where it's not necessarily a clear upgrade over staying in-house, because then they could use the prospects or, you know, whatever they have to give up to pursue some bullpen help or what have you. So, yeah, that seems like the most obvious fit for me is them going out and getting Cozart and maybe trying to grab a reliever. If only Drew Storen had not had a meltdown with the Nationals, you could almost see a package deal there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, maybe it'll be somebody else. Maybe it'll be like a Tony Cingrani. They could probably use the lefty or somebody like that who would come along. But yeah, I mean, the Reds need to eventually make some sort of move. So I would imagine that'd be something that
so
makes sense.
So I wonder if they stay in the National League East and look at the Mets. Because Asdrubal Cabrera is someone who had wanted to be traded. He's a shortstop who would be a quick fill-in for them because Turner will be back probably at the end of the year. I would assume. And then they could also grab like an Addison Reed or a Jerry Blevins or someone like that as term in terms of reliever. Do you think that the Mets would deal in division like that? And do you think the Nationals would even consider doing a deal like that?
I think the Nationals, I mean, excuse me, I think the Mets would definitely deal within the division if the price or the return was correct. I would guess the same is true of the Nationals. I don't see Mike Rizzo as someone who shies away from this sort of thing. I think Rizzo is more than willing to trade within the division if he gets a deal that he thinks is, acceptable or good or, whatever term you want to use here. So, yeah, I think that's a potential solution for both sides.
I'm not sure what Cabrera's previous tenure with the Nationals in 2014 left him with as in terms of a relationship with the organization. I don't see it as something that's an easy fit, so I'm not sure how that'll work out. But I kind of feel like there's going to be this race for Zach Cozart because I think there's a number of teams who could use, left side of the infield help, and I'm kind of baffled as to how it's going to kind of come out and if Cozart's going to recover well enough to really be part of this, because the options are so minimal. I think that, trying to be creative and dealing with somebody in the division, that's going to be something some team's going to have to do.
Yeah, sounds right. And it makes it funner.
True. Speaking of
True.
funner, we have Bartolo Colon. He was DFA'd, so I guess not funner for him, but Bartolo DFA'd. What are your thoughts?
He's been so bad and he's so old, and it just seems like the magic has gone there. But you know what? He's going to sign with the Mets any minute now. And yeah, look, have fun with that one, boys.
Yeah, I mean, so his ERA is obviously much, much worse than his peripherals, but the problem has been his control, his blessed, magnificent control over the last 5 years has kind of disappeared. He's walking twice as many guys as he had previously, and that means he's very, very bad, because he had no room to get worse as a pitcher and stay in the league. He's got an unbelievable 48% left on base percentage. Like everybody who gets on base is going. They're coming around to score. And that's a very bad sign. It's a little bit with luck, but probably not entirely. He's giving up good contact. Yeah, he's going to end up on the Mets because the Mets love former Mets, and he's not going to pitch particularly well, but he's probably going to pitch better than he did in Atlanta. And it'll be a nice little hand wave to the end of his career, and then, off to. I think RJ made the joke before before we started the show. He can go and spend time with his families, plural.
Enjoy his flower days, celebrations, and whatnot. But yeah, well, if Bartolo listened before, he's not gonna listen anymore. So
That's okay. We'll
we
live, I'm
lost
sure.
our faithful follower. So I got another DL stint for you. Chase Anderson strained his left oblique, and not in a way you would think coming from a pitcher. Unless you knew he played in the National League, because he swung and whiffed at a pitch and just strained an oblique, which, if that is not a reigning endorsement of the DH, I don't know what is. But he's potentially going to miss over a month, and for a Brewers team that's looking to stay in first, what do they do from here?
I don't know, but he's going to be tougher to replace than you think. He enters this DL stint with a 2.89 ERA, 3.15 K to walk ratio. Historically, he's been a slightly above average starter. Now he's having a pretty good year. And this is, like you said, Sean, just not the ideal situation for a Brewers team that's trying to hang on to that National League Central lead. So where do they go from here, Brian?
Yeah, I don't know. They don't have any depth to speak of. I mean, maybe they move Josh Hader to the rotation, something like that. But Anderson's a weird guy because his success this year seems to be driven off of something that I read from Paul Sporer of Rotographs, which is he seems to be elevating his fastballs a little bit more. And if for anyone who's listened to Effectively Wild recently, they talked a little bit about how that might be one of the almost like the magic bullets to deal with the fact that the home run rate is spiking and people are hitting more homers and the offense is going up a little bit. So I think that was an interesting thing to note that Anderson had been succeeding by using a few more pitches up in the zone. I'd like to see other pitchers try that, but you have to be successful at it. His strikeout rate's up, his velocity's ticked up a little bit. And all that's a nice way to say the Brewers don't have a lot of room for error in that rotation. Junior Guerra and Jimmy Nelson have been pretty good, but they don't have any depth behind them unless they move Hader up. So we were talking a couple episodes ago about how much we wanted to see the Brewers go out and make a move, and now this may make things a little bit more necessary for them to go out and get another starter.
That makes sense. And if you want to see pitchers throw that high fastball, just tune into a Rays or Dodgers game.
Oh, yeah.
Frankly, it kind of makes sense that the Brewers would follow that trend because they have a few former Rays executives in the front office. And obviously, Stearns comes from Houston, where – have you guys heard they're sort of into analytics? I don't know.
Yes.
I think that's a well-kept secret, right? So it makes sense that Milwaukee would chase that rabbit.
So stay within – a former Chase Anderson team, and that's the Arizona Diamondbacks. Nick Ahmed was diagnosed with a small fracture in his right hand a couple days ago. And so what the Diamondbacks did was they brought up Ketel Marte, who was one of the pieces of the Taijuan Walker trade this offseason. Marte has been tearing it up in AAA. He batted 338, 391, 514. So do we think that Ketel Marte is a solution for Ahmed's injury, or do we think they go out and get a Jed Lowry or Freddie Galvis or even an Eztrubel Cabrera?
I have to imagine that the Diamondbacks would stand pat on this. You know, Ahmed is not a guy who is giving them well above replacement level performance. He's a fielding only guy. He hits about 25% worse than the league average. He's nothing to write home about. And Marte has been playing well enough in the minors, just like you said, to think that he can at least do that. He can at least provide some replacement level, slightly better than replacement level performance. He's not the defender that Ahmed is. And if the Diamondbacks are really convinced that they need that plus defense at shortstop to, I don't know, help out the rest of the team, make up for some deficiencies in the rotation or something like that, then I could see them going out and trying to acquire a defense-first shortstop. But most of those guys you mentioned, Cabrera, Lowry, they certainly are not that. So I bet they just stand pat.
I agree with that. And also, you know, they have such a sizable lead in the wild card race. They have literally 9 fewer losses than the Cubs at this point. Why not give Marte a go? Why not see what he can offer? You traded for him for a reason, so they like him on some level, and it's hard for me to imagine that in their preseason planning, they didn't anticipate Marte perhaps even replacing Ahmed as the starting shortstop before the season ended. And like Brian said, Ahmed had a 79 OPS plus at this point. He's not much of a hitter. He's a glove-only dude. I don't know, maybe they regret not getting involved in the Adani Echevarria trade talks, or maybe they regret that they didn't happen like this week instead of last week. But for me, the answer is to just roll with Marte and see what he can bring to the table.
And we probably shouldn't forget about Chris Owings, who they've been using in kind of that super utility role. And Owings has been playing, you know, pretty well, especially recently. He's hitting above league average. He's providing some value on defense, if nothing else, through his versatility, and he can run the bases. So this is not a team that a giant hole has opened up as a result of this.
So we now go out to Philadelphia, and there is a big prospect coming up to the big league team, and that's Nick Williams. He is going to be making his big league debut on Friday. So we're recording Friday, so I guess we'll get to tell you about it next week. But the story might not be Williams himself. It might be that he is coming up for an injured Howie Kendrick, who is headed to the 10-day DL with a hamstring injury. Kendrick has been very good this year. What do we make of this?
It's a shame for Kendrick and for the Phillies because he was having a good year, seemed like a potential trade target as we approach the deadline. That said, I'm really curious to see Williams because his profile is hard for me to anticipate a ton of big league success, especially early on. He doesn't walk much, yet he's not the bat-to-ball type you would expect, perhaps. He strikes out a lot. I think his strikeout rate in AAA was nearing 30%. It was definitely above 25%. And we're talking about a walk rate that's like, if he walks like 5 to 6% of the time, everybody's like, look, he's showing more patience. So Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to make of Williams' prospects, especially in the short term, but I know this is a bummer for the Phillies because, again, Kendrick was putting together a nice year and reasonably could have been dealt at any point in the ensuing 4 weeks, and it would have made sense.
Yeah, this is also kind of an interesting time for Williams to come up. Williams, because of his weird profile that you were talking about, I don't think the Phillies front office loves the guy. I think they're trying to get him up, and because there's not much for him left to do at AAA. I mean, he's performed at a reasonably high level in AAA, but nothing to make anyone jump out and be like, okay, this guy's got to come up to the majors. But at the same time, there's not much for him left to do there, so it's time for him to come up. Of course, this weekend, the Phillies play the Mets. So if he starts today, Friday, he gets to face Jacob deGrom, which would probably not be ideal. That's not the sort of first attack of a starting pitcher that you'd want to go up against. But Saturday is kind of an unknown starter, and Sunday is the known quantity that is Rafael Montero. So if you want him to get off to a good start, sit him today, play him on Saturday and Sunday, and see how the weekend goes. Because I think he'll be in a better position to succeed. I don't think he's part of the Phillies' long-term plans, and I don't think they love this profile that you had talked about, so I'm not sure he's terribly long for the team either.
Brian, I didn't actually know that my Sunday recap was another Rafael Montero start. So thank you.
Yeah.
Completely
It's your job.
I think the one thing that sticks out too is Howie Kendrick in left field has been very good defensively. The Howie Kendrick outfield experience has worked out, it looks like.
Yeah, but they've also been playing Daniel Nava in left field. So, take that for what it's worth because of the needs that the team has. So, I mean, great for Howie Kendrick being a versatile player versus he's always been kind of athletic and kind of good at doing lots of different things. Even when he was back with the Angels, they put him in the outfield occasionally or first base or wherever. So it's good to see him doing well. I'm disappointed with the injury, and I think he'll have an interesting bunch of suitors in 2018.
I'm sure we will have a chance to talk about him later in the year, but for now we'll go to Dustin Fowler. Yankees prospect was called up, and I'm sure you all have seen the video of his knee not doing what knees do, and it was so bad that his open rupture of the right patella tendon in his right knee required emergency surgery, which you usually don't hear of with baseball injuries or sport injuries, unless it is very, very bad. And do you guys want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I certainly don't want to watch it. That was a pretty gross injury. And before this injury happened, Fowler, who was recently called up and playing in his first game, I kind of wanted to talk today about the Yankees and their commitment to bringing up all these young prospects, despite being in the thick of a race for the AL East and for that playoff spot. But if we're going to just focus on Fowler, I kind of feel like he had been playing very, very well in AAA. He had 13 homers and 13 steals. He's kind of got that combo power speed thing going for him. I'm concerned about his baseball future after this injury. I really feel for the guy, and I don't know how much else there is to say other than I just hope he's able to recover and get back in it soon because, he was going to be part of that really cool Yankees core possibly, and now. This is a pretty tough way to make your major league debut.
Yeah, I hope he recovers. And I mean, he didn't even get to take a major league at bat. He literally got hurt in the first inning. And, for his sake and for all of our sakes, I hope he makes a full recovery and he's right back in there next year. And in a couple of years, it's not a fun fact, but, a tidbit about his career, like, oh, did you know that in his first game, he suffered a significant injury and never even got to take a swing, so.
Best of luck to him going forward.
Absolutely. And so now we move to three DFAs. Danny Farquhar for the Rays, Jason Greely for the Jays, and Nick Franklin for the Brewers. So which of these will mean the most, and which of these three has a better chance at playing time going forward?
I would guess Farquhar. Because, I mean, we're basically saying here, which of these relievers are the Nationals going to pick up, right? I mean, that's what we're saying here. I would guess Farquhar because, I don't know, Grilly has the age aspect, and you never know that. Franklin, I mean, he just lost his biggest fan, and Matt Arnold, he's, I think he's a sensible bench solution for a team looking for a second baseman slash left fielder who can hit righties and who should never be allowed to face a left-handed pitcher. He doesn't really have the arm for the left side, but again, left field, second base, hits righties, that's going to get him a job somewhere, probably on a rebuilding team. But yeah, I would guess Farquhar is going to land on his feet pretty quickly, and it'll probably be with the Nationals. That's my guess.
See, I would go the exact opposite way. I think Grilly is like a perfect fit for the Nationals because we've seen before they love former closers who are old and past their prime with Rodriguez and with Joe Nathan and things like that. So Grilly I see as a guy who could very well get picked up because he is bad. He is a bad pitcher right now, but he still gets a lot of strikeouts, and his main issue this year has been with dingers. He's given up a home run on one in every three fly balls he's given up, which is, even when your stuff is down and you're not being as effective, that's probably a little unsustainable. So I would have to imagine that he will be a guy that some front offices will say, well, maybe he'll regress a little bit. Maybe he can get back a little bit to the way that where he was before, and especially if he's pitching in a little bit of a more pitcher-friendly park. So I'll put my money on him getting some sort of work, but obviously Nick Franklin's going to get a second look with somebody because, you know, the pedigree and the versatility and the simple fact that he probably can't be as bad as he was with the Brewers this year again.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Also, well, I would just say, though, is it really a second look at this point? This is going to be his fourth franchise. This is like a fourth look, and he's had a half a good season last year, maybe a quarter of a good season. So, and the thing about that is, you know, the Brewers were kind of anticipated to be in that rebuilding, let's take a look at these former top prospects stage, and, you know, their surprising contention kind of spelled the end for Nick Franklin.
Yeah, that's a good point. So maybe the White Sox that we talked about before, maybe that'll be somebody that they'd be interested in. But yeah, I just think that that you're probably right. He's probably what he is by now.
You know who would also make sense? The Padres, because they love those former top prospects. And I could definitely see them just slotting him in at shortstop and being like, yeah, he can't defend, but who cares, you know?
Yeah, too true.
Just give him that bats.
You know, it's a bit surprising at this point that Nick Franklin hasn't been a Padre. I had made the assumption that he spent some time there just because, yeah, I think that is the perfect fit for him. He seems like he will be wearing a Padre uniform and we'll see Franklin on the back of a jersey coming in, like, what, a week?
Maybe.
So going forward, now we're going to stick with the Nats bullpen. I know we've talked about the Nats bullpen ad nauseum for almost the entirety of the DFA show, all 15 episodes thus far. Kevin Jepsen signed with them. So there's that. What are they doing? What's going on there?
Back when Jepsen pitched for the Rays, we used to call him Tobacco Kev. And I mention that because it has about as much significance to this current topic as Kevin Jepsen will have to fixing the Washington Nationals bullpen. He hasn't pitched in the minors this season. He did a workout, I think, a week or two ago, and clearly it went somewhat well because he landed a deal, but I don't think he's the solution. And best case scenario, he's an okay middle reliever who adds to their depth, even if he doesn't really solve the biggest issues with them as it pertains to like high leverage situations.
Yeah, the Nats go after a guy with lots of experience and some saves in his past. Shocker. I had the fun job this offseason of studying him so that I could write him up for the BP annual, and it was not a fun job. It wasn't fun at all. And his issue has been he's always been very good at keeping the ball down. Well, in 2016, he didn't really keep the ball down. And workout or no, it'll be interesting to see if he can do that again once he actually starts pitching. I would have felt a lot better about the signing if he had, say, for example, had a really good ground ball rate in AAA, but he didn't even pitch in AAA. So I imagine this is one of those things where he, just like RJ said, he's going to be completely insignificant to this team. It's going to take him a while to get ramped up, and we won't really hear much from him. Maybe he'll do well enough in the minor league system for the Nats to get some sort of call in 2018.
So we are moving to St. Louis now. The Cardinals optioned Aledmys Diaz to AAA, which seems weird because they also employ Paul DeJong and Greg Garcia. But what's going on here? Because Diaz was a guy that wasn't supposed to be good last year. Or was it 2 years ago?
It was all another slump.
Ever.
He was really a surprise because if you remember, he passed through waivers at the end of the 2015 season. It might have been the offseason of 2015, 2016, went unclaimed. And some of that was because of his contract, but some of it was because the expectation there was he would not become more than a utility infielder. So last year really came out of left field. And the Cardinals here, they're sending Diaz down, and they're going with DeJong as their most aged shortstop. He's actually hit surprisingly well. And I say surprisingly well because in 99 plate appearances, he has drawn one walk and has struck out 31 times. Yet he's hitting 278, 283, 485. Realistically, is that going to continue? Probably not. But, you know, he did have a good run in AAA this season with a somewhat similar profile. Hit 299, 339, 571. He's kind of come out of nowhere because he was a fourth round pick in 2015. And I don't think he made any of the Cardinals prospect list. I can check on that while Grosnick talks. So Grosnick, do your talking now. Flip that up.
It's funny because I don't have much to say about DeJong either. Diaz is a little bit surprising because he was pretty good all season, so it didn't entirely look like a fluke. He hit for more power, and he was more patient than we expected him to be. And this season, that's all gone backwards. He's got an on-base percentage below 300. He's not hitting for the same kind of power that he did last year. So it was kind of like 2016 was this beautiful mirage, and we're back to the Ledmus Diaz that we know and love, which is a AAA shortstop at this point. With DeJong, like, you can't discount Cardinals devil magic. I don't think that's fair to do, but I think Diaz is kind of a good example of the fact that the Cardinals devil magic doesn't always stick around forever. Sometimes a guy will kind of pop up and then, you know, fade away. You've got Pete Cosmo was exciting for a year, maybe, sort of exciting for maybe half a year. Maybe Pete Cosmo's not the best example, but there are other guys for the Cardinals, Matt Adams, Randall Grichuk, who will pop up and will display the devil magic for a little bit and then regress a little bit back to what they were before they made it to the major leagues with the Cardinals. I think we've got another team who could use a shortstop here. I think we're going to keep talking about this a lot because if the Cardinals really want to make a push for the wild card, and I'm not sure that they do, they would be another team that would be well served to go outside the organization and try to find somebody.
Yeah, and just to revisit DeJong and the Cardinals, gentlemen with the thistle down hair tendencies, this is what we wrote about him. This is what BP wrote about him during the prospect season. This was by Matt Pullman. He was not ranked in the top 10, by the way, but this is what he wrote about him. Selected in the fourth round of the 2015 draft out of Illinois State University, DeJong went from the Redbirds to the Cardinals organization. Playing almost exclusively shortstop in the Arizona Fall League, DeJong showcased his ability to fill out the position in an emergency role, something which could prove necessary for his overall profile to work at the major league level. There's some over-the-fence power here, hitting the fifth most home runs in the Texas League this summer. However, he combines average and best bat speed with an unrefined feel for the barrel, and what can only project as a below average hit tool at the moment. Of course, it is the Cardinals, and good little caveat there by Pullman. Of course, it is the Cardinals, and of course, DeJong has played probably over his head. So, yeah, maybe they go outside the organization, but realistically, should the Cardinals go outside the organization at this point, or do you think they've kind of come to terms with the fact that they are almost certainly not making the postseason? So it's worth running DeJong out there and seeing what he can do with the stick against big league pitchers.
I think you're absolutely right. I don't think it's worth it for the Cardinals to give up assets to go try to get somebody else unless it's somebody that they think they can get very cheaply or for no particular – like when you talk about Asdrubal Cabrera, I think that's the type of guy who's going to be a good fit for this Cardinals team if they do want to go outside the organization. He's a guy that they could theoretically move around even though, you know, Asdrubal Cabrera is not very fond of that, but they could try to bring somebody in like that and then use DeJong in a utility role, switch him out, get some at-bats. But I don't see it. I think they'll just run with their own guys because that's what the Cardinals like to do. They like to give their guys a shot and give them every opportunity to succeed. So I think that's what will happen. DeJong will get plenty of ABs, and we'll see how they turn out.
It's so curious to me because Greg Garcia is still on this roster. His batting average, or his slugging percentage is 263. Aledmys Diaz's average is 260. So, like, there was clear struggles there, but it seemed like it was Greg Garcia, the one who probably should have found the minors, and they called up Alex Mejia to take his spot, and Mejia wasn't really that great in AAA, 263, 333, 289. So, are they trying to make a statement?
I think the only statement they're trying to make is that all of their options in the middle infield aren't particularly good. I think it's more just about, I mean, if you look at the Cardinals right now, they are an incredibly shallow team. They don't have a lot of good depth. Their bench right now is Mejia, Jose Martinez, Luke Voigt, who I'm pretty sure he's just a made-up name. Somebody was like, "Oh, that sounds cool," and Eric Fryer as their kind of bench. So this is not a team with a lot of depth, and in the upper minors, they don't have a lot of depth. So I think they're just kind of desperate.
I would agree with that. And yeah, it used to be a trademark of the Cardinals that it always felt like every year they would bring up a dude to the bench who was clearly overqualified to be on the bench, and that's not happening anymore. I mean, you mentioned Luke Voigt. I mean, did you know who this dude was? If you wouldn't have just looked at their roster page, like, would you have even known he was in the majors? Probably not.
No, I even
Even Luke.
mispronounced his last name. So,
Yeah, I think it's
definitely.
Voigt. I honestly don't know if it's Voigt or Volt. It's Voigt. I have not seen a plate appearance from him. He's only made seven this season across four games. So, yeah, I don't know. He was a 22nd round pick, and to his credit, he did mash in AAA this season. 322, 406, 561. However, I would anticipate that he's not going to have much of a big league career. So,
And I would anticipate that Cardinals devil magic. So we'll wait and see.
womp womp.
So, from Cardinals Devil Magic to a former NL Central closer, who is really the reason I was staving off moving off of Aledmys Diaz, and that's Mark Melancon. He went to the 10-day DL with a right pronator strain, had a PRP injection. They said there's no structural damage. What is Mark Melancon? Is this even a passing thought at this point? How bad he's been this year? How home run prone he's been this year? Do we think that he's even a trade chip should he be able to come back?
This is the opposite of Cardinals double magic. This is San Francisco Giants odd year magic. I mean, I don't think he's a trade chip. I don't think he was a trade chip beforehand because I don't think the Giants are necessarily going to go into total rebuild mode. I suppose the bright side here is if you're a Giants fan, you can look at his home run and hitability issues this season and perhaps ascribe them to an injury or to being less than 100%. The problem is, and this is very obvious, you don't really want him to have injury issues. You sign a dude who had been a well above average reliever for years and years and years. You don't want him breaking down in the first year of his contract. So it's sort of a double-edged sword there. Yes, it gives him a convenient excuse for some of his issues, but he's still not even a quarter of the way through a 4-year, $62 million deal. So, which one of those weighs heavier if you're a Giants fan? You're probably going to go with the injury aspect because at least that gives you some kind of silver lining, even if it's not necessarily a good silver lining.
Yeah, I definitely think this removes any doubt that the Giants could possibly trade Melanson because it makes no sense to deal him now when he's dealing with an injury issue and ineffectiveness because they can't get back for him what they would need to make that deal. Like if there was a team like the one to go out and spend the what the Cubs paid for Aroldis Chapman or what the Indians paid for Andrew Miller this offseason, then yeah, sure you would make him available because that's a huge shot in the arm to a team, but there's no way anybody's going to give that to the Giants for a damaged, ineffective Melanson. They'll have to wait until next year until he's able to recoup some value to deal him. And by next year, they may not want to deal him because they may be good again, just like RJ said. So it's another blow to a year that the Giants wish never happened. But at the same time, it's really not all that significant for this team. They weren't going to use him to win a bunch of games, and they weren't going to deal him. So it's just kind of like everybody is like, yeah, we'll just focus on Grant Brisby's new TV show and forget about watching the actual games.
I suppose I would play devil's advocate just a little bit here. If you're the Giants and a team comes to you, let's say the Nationals, and they offer you a C prospect or a B prospect in exchange for eating all of Melanson's contract. Do you at least consider that?
Sure, I think you would consider it. You have to at least consider that kind of reset button on a deal like this, which, you know, when the Giants signed the Melanson deal, you have to figure they were really only looking at it as a good value in the first couple or first 3 years, because you never sign a reliever to a 4 or 5 year deal and expect the end of it to look beautiful. So I would think they would consider it. And, you know, if they wanted to get another top tier reliever, they could always try again at free agency or something like that. If it's a C prospect, I don't know, because I just don't know how much the Giants really value those level of guys. But I mean, I would think they'd at least consider it. I just don't think there is any team that would be like, yeah, we'll take Melanson, we'll take all of his contract at this point, because he's such a question mark.
You have to think that if they did that, that would be the greatest signal that they might be ready for a rebuild, because that was their big thing that they were going out and get. That was their big, this is what we need to shore up the bullpen and like to win the division this year and to really contend. And the sell-off, I mean, do you think that that would be a signal that they're ready to do, maybe not a full rebuild and tear everything down, but a rebuild of sorts?
I think it would just be a signal that maybe they're not confident in Melanson's ability to get back to where they want him to be. And, you know, they had a really rough start to the season from their bullpen, and I'm sure the overall numbers aren't great. But I would point out, you know, Contos has a 148 ERA plus, Garrett has a 211, Hunter Strickland has a 186. You know, they've had some good relief performances. So we give them a lot of trouble for not going out and doing more to their bullpen this winter, and it's deserved. But at the same time, you know, they have had some individual strong performances in the pen, and I don't know. I guess I'd be curious, like, would they even consider it, or are they that confident in Melanson, and are they that confident in their chances of competing again as soon as next year? Because like Brian said, realistically, they're probably going to get 2 good years from Melanson and 1 acceptable one before he falls off or, you know, craters, gets hurt, whatever. So they have 1 good year remaining for him. I guess I'd just be curious how highly they value that versus getting rid of the contract and trying again this winter.
Yeah, the Giants are in kind of a precarious position, right? Because they are an expensive team. Yeah. They've got a lot of big money contracts, so being able to hit the reset button on one big contract might be beneficial to them. And then at the same time, they've got Johnny Cueto with his opt-out this year, and we're not entirely sure what he's going to do there, but I would kind of assume he's going to look to opt out or at least restructure his contract with the Giants to get more money, because he can. But that would just be my guess. And then they've got this money committed to Matt Cain with his 2018 option, which I assume isn't going to get picked up. We've got Jeff Samardzija. We've got Melanson, who goes through 2020. So I just I'm not 100% sure that this team is really what they're going to do. I think they can go a couple of different ways. And if they were to deal Melanson, I do think that would be a sign that they're going to do something different. But I don't know if that would be to spend the money somewhere else, or if it would be to try to move on and do a little bit of a soft rebuild.
And before we move on here, I just want to touch on Matt Cain's contract, because, yeah, his $21 million team option is not going to get picked up. However, the buyout is $7.5 million. You know, that's
a huge buyout.
Right, that's a significant buyout. So it's not like they're just getting, you know, $20 million there in savings. They're going to be paying him. I know it's, you know, not quite the amount for a win, but they're going to be paying him a significant amount to just go away. And I mean, you can't blame him. Obviously, you don't want to pay him to stick around. Just that's crazy. That's, you know, that's a it's a heck of a situation. And you're right, I don't quite know what they're going to do other than just try to retool and try to get one more competitive season out of this group before contemplating hitting the reset button.
Yeah, and the other thing that's kind of challenging about this team is that they, as far as trade assets go, I don't think they have very much. Yeah, the guys that they have as trade assets are obviously, you know, Belt, Posey, and like Madison Bumgarner, but those are guys that the team has come out and said they're certainly not going to trade. Oh, and Brandon Crawford. And yeah, of those guys, like, you could see the Giants parting ways with Brandon Belt, I think, but Posey and Crawford and Bumgarner are not going anywhere no matter what the Giants decide to do, rebuild, retool, whatever.
And even entering this deadline, the Giants have what, three dudes they could realistically trade? Eduardo Nunez seemed like the most likely to go. Maybe Denard Span, probably not. And then
I do think Joe Panik could be an interesting trade target,
you think
right?
they'd
I mean,
actually move him though?
I don't know. It doesn't make any sense for them to move him unless, I don't know, Jaeguon Hwang turns into a star and also can play second base, which that seems really unlikely, but I guess it
Yeah.
could happen.
I'm glad you
But
said his name because I'm not sure the draw is going to let me say that. I'm going to be honest with you. Jaeguon Hong. Is that how you, Wong?
I that's what I'm going with, but
Wow. Okay. So he's going to turn 30 in like 4 weeks. So good. Good for him.
yeah, like if the Giants dealt Panic, they might be able to get something back for him, but that would, if they do even consider competing next year, I don't think they want Kelby Tomlinson as their everyday second baseman. So I don't see it happening.
There's also Christian Arroyo to factor in there, because
But Arroyo is really going to play third base most likely, right?
yeah,
Not second.
that's true, but
So, RJ, I will say one thing though. You mentioned Matt Cain's big buyout. That beats our question from a previous show of if there's a bigger buyout that's going to be like absolutely done than Anibal Sanchez's
good call.
$5 million buyout. So that yeah, we've done it. We've
That's how
beaten
the
the internet.
universe works, Brody. You ask. You ask it, and it will provide you the answer in due time. You just have to be on the lookout for the answer. So, thank you, universe.
So we'll move to our final topic now, and that's John Gray. And he's been on the DL for quite a while, since about April, with a left foot stress fracture. He's been good in two starts in AAA, 13 strikeouts in 9 1/3 innings, gave up 10 hits, 6 runs, 2 earned. He gave up 2 home runs in one of those starts, and in that start, one of those home runs must have been unearned because he gave up 5 runs with 1 unearned run. And unearned home runs are probably my favorite thing in all of baseball. So, what do we expect from John Gray? Because he was pretty bad pre-injury.
Well, I'm happy to see him come back, but it's tough to imagine that he's going to be an upgrade over somebody like Tyler Anderson, who'd been pitching pretty well. I think he'll eventually right the ship. I'm just not 100% sure he's going to get back to that level that he was at last season right away. He does seem to be having some issues, and again, he's going to wind up pitching in Colorado for a bunch of his starts. The control didn't seem to come back all the way in those AAA starts, and that was really one of the things that was killing him the most in his three pre-injury starts. So I think they'll have to give him every opportunity to pitch, but I think the Rockies are probably going to be happier to roll with the other guys, and I don't know, maybe throw Senzatella back into the rotation at some point.
And I'm just glad he's back because he's one of my favorite pitchers. He's a very interesting fellow. As y'all know, he partakes in the honorable exercise of afterlife research, the same area that such luminaries as William Barrett and Alfred Russel Wallace and William Crookes and James Hyslop spent a lot of their time examining. So it's good to have an honorable young man like John Gray back in the majors.
And that's it for our show. John Gray and RJ, Ghost Hunters.
Let's go ghost hunting, John Gray. You got peak John Gray. Let's do it. That is actually one of my dream pieces, to go ghost hunting with John Gray. And I don't know. I think that would be fascinating. Nobody would believe us if we found anything, but it doesn't matter. It's just about the experience, right? And
I could see you guys doing 6 episodes on CBS All Access of
listen, we should definitely do a TV show of haunted ballparks or whatever, or just go around with ball players looking for spectral evidence, so to speak. So
We're getting that development deal going for you, RJ. We'll find a way to make that happen at some point, but
don't tease me.
to find out more about the DFA podcast, you can find us on Twitter at DFA Podcast. You can find RJ's work at CBS Sports. You can find RJ combing through the texts on spirits and the like. We're just teasing.
Attending a seance, apparently. Let's I got a solution for your troubles, Giants. Come to me. We'll channel the old Matt Cain, you know. We'll make it worth that money.
Oh, my goodness. We are so far afield right now. You can find more from Sean at Beyond the Box Score and at BP Mets, where he covers every Rafael Montero start because, I don't know, I think management doesn't like him or something. I think that's the only reason that would be taking place.
I got the first three Noah Syndergaard starts, so this is my pittance. This is my payment.
Well, that's fair, I guess. I mean, you got to take the good with the bad. And we'd really appreciate it if you found the DFA podcast on iTunes and gave us a rating or a review. We have one wonderful review. We could certainly use a couple of more. They help people find the show and listen in on the off chance they might be interested. But I'd like to say thank you to Sean. Thank you to RJ. Thank you to John Gray for providing such good content. And,
yeah, we're going to need the reviews because after this one, that review is going to disappear. That's going to be the ghost. Where did it go?
And there we go. We go full circle. See you guys next time.